It is Saturday, August 25th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Trox. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the room with me is Mr. Ben Jeff. He's a web instructor and a world traveler. Hi, Ben.
Hey, I love that theme. We don't play it very often.
Classic theme. I know. I love it. But then again, every time we play that theme, we can't say we own the Creative Commons on the whole thing and can give away the show.
That's true.
With that little restriction of someone else owning the copyright. So,
but it's such a, I don't know, nostalgic
upbeat,
theme.
Fun. I know. Yeah. And it's already in the board, so I don't have to use my laptop.
It's really easy. Nice.
You know, every week I introduce you and myself. I rarely do. I work at UCSC in a high-tech arts program called the Digital Arts New Media Program. And I work with students and artists, researchers, creating new art. And I'm undereducated in that environment, right? Everybody I work with is working on their MFA or has a PhD. And you, Ben, you've got an undergraduate degree.
Yes, I do. Now, in theater arts.
We're technically very undereducated in the professional realm, but you and I are both self-educated, as was Miles and the rest of the geeks. I traditionally have geeks on the program that stick for long periods of time that have not done their doctorate work. Basically, a lot of autodidactics, like us. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say that we're lacking in any way, but it is sometimes difficult to feel like you're really on top of your game when you're surrounded by highly decorated scholars.
Yeah, it's why we never announce our credentials on the air.
Right. I also think the other reason why we don't have regular geeks, exactly, the other reason we don't have regular geeks on the program is quite simply because, I mean, I should say regular geeks, we don't have highly educated geeks on the program is because, well, they're busy with really important jobs. We are not.
Wait, what are you insinuating?
I'll just insinuate anything. In the air with me, we also have Dr. Fiona Mulvey, a music philosophy and cognitive neuropsychology geek. Ben, you did that to me. You're like, you sure you can say neuropsychology? Yes, I can. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fiona, hi. I'll just call you Fiona today. Hi, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We'll be talking about your research more directly in the second half of the program. Ben, you would like to introduce our other doctor?
Oh, I suppose I would. He is coming up on my screen right now. Okay, here we go. Professor Kenneth Holmquist, a cognitive neuropsychology, computer science, linguistics, and bicycling geek.
Thank you very much, Ben. Good to be here.
Yeah. So today on the program, we're going to be in the first half, we're going to be doing news, and you guys are both welcome to join us for the news. If anything you would like to participate, please feel free to do so. It's a loose conversation about technology. Go ahead and get that mic nice and close to your face so you're nice and clear in our ears. And we're going to go on, and in the second half, of course, we're going to talk about neuropsychology and eye movement, actually. We're going to talk a lot about how the human eyes work, how we can track them, and what kind of technology we can get from the ability to understand where a person's looking. As simple as that. I know it's more complicated, but does that sound right?
Sounds perfect.
Wonderful.
Great.
I'm really excited about that because actually I met Fiona in Copenhagen on my first travel through Europe. And I couch surfed at her house, and we stayed up until 7 in the morning talking about eyes. And it was just ridiculous and amazing. And now I know a lot more about eyes than I did before. So, yeah, that's a fun.
What have your eyes spied this week in geek news?
Okay, so a absolutely reprehensible act. The Curiosity, that's the Mars rover, attacked N-165. N-165 is a rock on Mars, and the Curiosity
Didn't
rover.
Stand a chance.
The Curiosity rover is there to do science, and one of the instruments it has is a laser attached to its head, and it zapped a rock to test out a laser, and that rock happened to have a Twitter account, N-165 Mars. And so if you read this rock's tweet, it's things like, "What a lovely day here in Gale Crater. How nice." And then, you know, "Oh, there appears to be something coming in from the sky. What
that
is
has never happened ever."
Yeah, I know. It's really strange in my billions of years being here. And then, you know, "Oh, wow, this robot just landed it's looking at me kind of funny. And then, you know, okay, it's nighttime.
This is over multiple days.
Yeah. And then the next morning, it's like, oh, hello from Gale Crater again, la di da di da. And, but then it starts tweeting these more foreboding tweets, like, the robot is looking at me even more strangely. The robot just went in a circle. I wonder if it wants to be friends. The robot
it's dancing with me.
The robot is coming over to me. He's looking at me really funny. Like, I wonder if he wants to. And you know, so some people on Twitter got caught wind of this Twitter account and started tweeting back things like, "Watch out for Curiosity Robot. It has a laser attached to its head. You're gonna get it." And the rock is like, "Oh no, of course that's ridiculous. Why would it have any problems with a rock like me? You know, I'm just minding my own business." And then its next tweet is, "Ow, ow, 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 stop it, stop it." Why? So I thought we were friends.
Why did this cute little robot, actually the size of a car, decide to destroy that or hit that rock with the laser? What was its purpose? Well, it was just a test, right?
It had to test its laser on something. The problem is that we didn't know that Mars rocks had Twitter accounts and were sentient. I
mean, we had no idea.
Yes. So anyway, a little more information about this. The ChemCam is the name of the instrument, and it zapped the laser with 30 pulses of infrared light over a 10-second period. And each of these pulses, I mean, these must have been painful because they were over 1,000,000 watts of power for about 5 billionths of a second each. And it was primarily just to test out the laser, but it's going to be zapping things to see what happens, and then therefore infer things about the rock and the chemical composition and things like that. We're looking for... Curiosity's main mission is to look for different markers that would indicate that life could have existed. So, for example, the presence of water and things like that. So, pretty cool story. Really, really sad. This poor rock.
Defenseless rock.
This is what happens when you get a bunch of geeks all working together on something like that. Some random geek creates a Twitter account for a rock and starts being funny. It's kind of amazing.
Thank you very much, Ben, for the story on testing on lasers on Mars. Awesome. You know, I was just doing some stuff at work, and we have ability to purchase things. And one of the things you cannot purchase in a certain way are lasers.
Like, really?
It must be a holdover from some contract or something, lab equipment from years ago. But yeah. I'm not allowed to buy a laser with, you know, the credit card I use for work.
Even just a little laser?
It just says laser. It's like laser pointer. Why I can't buy a CD player? I mean, where does it go?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, that's kind of funny.
That's kind of amazing. So when I was a kid, my parents wouldn't let me buy a laser pointer for the longest time.
There's laser pointers when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Are you, 50? First laser I had was a tube I had to make.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anyway.
You're old, I'm young, you know, insults all around. But yeah, I was really upset because I don't know, like, I'm not going to shine it at a plane or something like that, but...
That would be okay, actually.
But finally, they did finally let me get a laser, and I think for my 15th birthday present, I got a present, and it was in the shape of a laser when it was all wrapped up, and I was really excited. I thought it was going to be a laser, but it was like some pencil microscope or something like that. But finally, when I was 18, they gave me the symbolic gift of a very weak, small laser pointer.
And then when you got the weak, small laser pointer, did you take the pen microscope and take a look at the beam?
Exactly.
Is that bad for the eyes, you guys?
I would think so. I wouldn't do it myself.
Yeah, I would assume. So a new story I want to cover. I'm sure no one has heard of this. Did you know that Samsung got an injunction from Apple for $1 billion? You hear about that?
Oh, yeah.
No, it's everywhere. Yeah. The story is pretty simple. The Samsung's phone lines and Apple's phone lines are very similar. There's a lot of patents. Went to court. The jury basically came in favor to Apple and awarded like $1 billion. Have you seen the list of all the phones and how much money per phone it was? This is the fun thing. It's all these different phones, and all of them have certain amounts. So like the Galaxy Ace, JX1030, has $0 awarded, but the Galaxy Prevail had $57,863 awarded. It just lists out until it sums up to $1 billion. Now,
oh my gosh.
The thing that's ridiculous about this, and I'm sure people are hearing about this to some degree, is that patent work in the tech industry is very much about large companies trading patents with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Apple to do this, it's a little strange. I was surprised that they did the suit in the first place, because it seems like it's not the right way to do it. You're putting yourself in the front of the public very, you know, very publicly. Now, Apple did win completely because more than $1 billion, which isn't actually that important in the large scale of how much money these guys companies are making. What's important is that it now looks like always that Apple is the leader and the innovator and Samsung is trying to catch up. And that's a nasty place to be in from a consumer space.
Yeah, that's true. And some of these patents were things like flat surface with rounded corners that you can touch or something like that, you know, where like, how far do you really want to go with these things? I'm sure that there are plenty of patents from like the 1800s that if you really stretch it could probably, you know, could probably fulfill some of those requirements.
A lot of the buzz in the tech space is that the jurors didn't know what they were doing. Right, that was like the general consensus. The jurors don't know anything. I tend to have a lot more faith in a jury because I've been in that space, and it's a very, you know, first off, both sides get to pick their jurors. Very, you know, it's a long process to pick the jurors.
Yeah,
so they were vetted
out anyone.
Yeah, so we're not talking about the person that can't understand the topic, right? We're talking about people that, on both sides were at least at some level assessed as competent to just discuss this and think about this.
Yeah.
And then they do a lot. They have a lot of weight on their shoulders. So I don't think that you can blame that space. I think what's clear about this is that the patent structure and technology right now is so messed up and weird that this kind of thing can happen easily.
Like, yeah,
that shouldn't be the case. And the truth is they probably did a lot of arguing about the details of these patents or how patents work and how, you know, if you, and in that space, you get into this place where the judge is saying, now keep in mind, you might not like the idea of a patent in this space, but this is the law. And so there's a lot of that going on as well.
Yeah.
But in the chain, I mean, we have seen Galaxy, or excuse me, if we have seen these other companies, you know, not just Apple, Samsung does a lot of innovation and Apple copies them. And so that's one of the things that's been fun is seeing those threads of, well, here, notification center is something that Samsung actually came up with, you know, was in the Android OS, if you will. Now, of course, the Android OS is an open source Creative Commons place, and therefore you can take things from it. But so
you end up with companies countersuing each other over and like just back and forth and back and forth. And it does seem kind of petulant on some level. And it definitely does also show how broken our patent system is for things like this. When you get big companies involved, then, you know, the original idea of patents was to protect innovation for, I think, originally meant for specific inventors, you know? So, like, some guy comes up with an idea, he patents it, and then some big company can't come wrest it away from him.
Well, yeah, it's really about... do either of you own patents in your environment?
Not me.
No.
Nothing. We've thought about it, but we never did it.
So what about the whole protective aspect? If you think of something, you start implementing something, and then later on down the lines, let's say a research project comes along, and you take that into the next space of it becoming a product or it being part of a product, and another company like Samsung comes along and takes it from you. I mean, are you concerned about that, or is it really you don't care about the productification, of course, most likely? Being researchers,
I mean, in the eye tracking business, the tradition has been to be very researcher close and open with your products, and to share. But that has changed in the recent 10 years, and we are starting to see patent wars in our business as well.
Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, it's of course. Well, we'll talk more about eye tracking in a bit, but there is definitely a completely new type of interface that can occur with eye tracking, effective eye tracking, small eye tracking. Ben, next story.
Absolutely.
Please.
So, you know, I've only now, just now, realized this as a trend. We've been talking a lot about stories having to do with self-driving cars and car safety and things like that. It seems to really be a new topic that's coming up very, very often. So in Ann Arbor, Michigan, they're outfitting 2,800 cars, trucks, and buses with these new wireless devices. And the idea is that these wireless devices within the cars, they know where they are geographically, right? Mm-hmm. And they also know their speed, and they also know the status of the vehicle that they're in. And you can put these things together and network them in order to have them notify each other of, say, slowdowns in the road or erratically driving vehicles or things like that, with the idea that it would increase road safety in general, right? It's a $25 million project, and they've actually shown on smaller scales that these kind of devices can cut down on traffic crashes. It's kind of a cool project, right? My big question, though, and this isn't something that they addressed in the article, is when you have things like this, oh, by the way, they're communicating via Wi-Fi, right? They're creating a gigantic Wi-Fi network. I just saw you grimace, right? Security, like, how do you protect against some rogue vehicle or some virus or something taking over vehicles or polluting the other vehicles with erroneous data and things like that, right? These vehicles can, in some cases, actually change traffic lights to be green in the direction of their travel if other cars aren't coming the other way, which is a really cool idea.
How many vehicles are these?
2,800 in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Autonomous, or are they assisted?
Oh no, they're assisted. They're not autonomous. They're driven by humans.
So the general idea, I mean, it's something we've all wanted, right? You come to a stoplight, you wait 30 seconds, no other cars have shown up or anything, and then you go. That's a dumb stoplight, right?
Or why not? Sunnyvale, where I live right now, you wait 2-3 minutes, and then you get stuck at the very next traffic light, which is only 100 meters.
Right. Smarter traffic has been a desire for
Sunnyvale traffic lights.
So these cars allow you to start. I mean, is it basically a research project to discern
right now
whether it's going to be effective?
Yeah, right now it's in the research phase. It's just telling the motorist things like brake because traffic ahead, or brake because there's a vehicle running a stoplight or something.
Or
like
you need
that,
to slow down 2 miles per hour speed. If you do, you'll be more efficient in travel. That kind of thing we're talking about, right?
I'm not sure if they're doing that level of detail, that granularity quite yet. But definitely in terms of increasing efficiency and also increasing road safety, it's a really good idea. But at the same time, I guess the part of me that enjoys disaster movies thinks, gosh, there's so many ways this could be... this could be hacked into and broken or messed up or actually cause things to be worse in certain situations. So anyway, hopefully they're thinking about security. Luckily at this point, the vehicles are not driving themselves, you know, so.
Right. Well, there are vehicles driving themselves, of course.
Those vehicles are not.
We even have autonomous vehicles in California. Now, there's a human being in there that can take over, but Google does drive autonomous vehicles in California. You don't need to have any laws or any rules about it, as long as you've got a driver that's really supposedly in charge.
Wow. I didn't realize that. Not. Yeah, Nevada is, I think it's Nevada.
Yeah, they're licensed.
It's Nevada.
Arizona?
Yeah. Can't recall. No, it's Arizona. Arizona. I get them confused. I don't know. Maybe they're next to each other or something. God, I'm such a horrible with geography. But in any case, they have laws that are kind of going through the process of moving towards allowing autonomous vehicles to drive themselves without human intervention in certain situations in certain locations.
So this program that you're talking about as a study is putting a lot of cars in the market that make them very much more intelligent with the way traffic flow works. So stoplights get modified depending on what the cars are assessing and figuring out. Mm-hmm. And so this sounds a lot more like... the human being is completely in charge. Of course, we found that even when a human being is in charge and being told instructions that are erroneous, accidents can occur. You know, turn left here, people sometimes do.
They turn into a lake or something.
Yeah, so humans are not exactly the most reliable of machines.
Yeah, that's true. But here's the other question, which we've discussed previously, but I'll just bring up briefly now, is what happens when computers are better than humans at driving? Will we relinquish control of our vehicles, or do we have so much trust in our own instincts that even if computers are better, we'll trust ourselves more than the computers?
I would like the former. I'm sure that most people will feel the latter for a while.
I would agree, yeah.
Though, I mean, if you can show, of course, that less people die, it's really hard to make an argument that would say, well, it doesn't matter if less people die.
Oh, wait,
like
wait. Who's making logical arguments?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I want to let you know about a show on Sunday. The universe gets weirder. According to the latest physics theories that we used to think of as the entire universe may just be a small part of a bigger, older, and much stranger totality. Thank you. On this edition of the 7th Avenue Project, which is tomorrow, Robert talks to theoretical physicist Anthony Ugira, yeah, there you go, about some of the head-spinning but not totally insane implications of the new cosmology. That's on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow here on KUSP. On KSP right now is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Professor Kenneth Holmquist and Dr. Fiona Mulvin and Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is here every week, of course. We're not taking calls this week. We are just going to be talking about cognitive neuropsychology.
We have an email from someone who said, I'm listening to the show live right now, which I don't usually get a chance to do. I was hoping on the live show you could say what happened to the downloaded podcast. What is happening to the podcast?
That's wonderful.
Thanks very much. So
I thought the people didn't mix. Like we had the radio people that have been happy for months not knowing anything's wrong. And the podcast people that just don't know if we exist
or
not.
Well, you know what? We've actually, over this last week, we've gotten three or four. This is, I think, the fourth or the fifth email. Asking like what
out of
is 7, going on
with you guys? 7,000 people that download the podcast,
right.
Only 3 or 4 really care.
Only 3 or 4 actually listen.
Well, I was up till 3 o'clock last night coding. I have the XML file working. I have everything going. I was going to come in this morning with it functional. When I launched the app last night up on the server, I had 2 bugs that I think are emerging because of PostgreSQL's configuration on the server versus on my laptop. Very, very close. In fact, you could see a demo of it.
I didn't understand a word of that.
I know,
but,
isn't that awesome?
But
hand waving mumbo jumbo doesn't work yet.
Yeah, right.
But what I'm going to do, this will be the first. I'm not going to retroactively add all those feeds to the feed slowly and let people download. I will make sure that NPR grabs all the old shows so that you can grab them through RSS reader. But if you're a podcast listener of our show, what you're going to want to do is go into your podcast reader of whatever it's downloading your RSS and look at the past shows and grab them individually. You have to download them by yourself.
Yeah,
you have download all set up.
Yeah.
But there might be a little bit confusion, complication. I'm not sure how it's going to work, but really close.
I've been telling people that they're going to get an uber dose of geek.
No, they won't.
Well,
they'll get
one
and they'll decide if they're going to listen to them.
If you get this one, and you're listening to it right now, go to your podcast, whatever you use to subscribe to GeekSpeak, be it on your iPad or your iPod or your Android phone or iTunes or any of these things, wherever you pull that feed, and update all of the old shows.
Not Apple, is that what you just said?
Oh, no, I did not.
Yes, and download the old shows. This is the fourth show that's not up, right? So once you get this, there'll be 3 that were not downloaded. Those 3, only one of them was actually any good. So
I disagree with that. They were all pretty good.
I haven't heard them. But you have a geek bit? Well, that was our geek bit today.
Oh,
unless
yeah.
You got one.
I do have a geek bit. Microsoft has a new logo. It is 4 squares. That's all. Go look at it. It's kind of amazing. Like they redesigned their logo, and it is quite simply 4 squares. It looks like
are they different
2x2
colors?
2x2 Rubik's Cube. Yeah, the red, green, blue, and yellow.
The Windows window colors.
Yeah, same colors as Google, but a little bit more muted.
Retro.
Yeah, more retro.
More like Windows 3.1 when they came up with those colors. Is it the same colors?
What was 3.1? Was it? I think
it
was
the Windows logo. You know that Windows logo?
Yeah, and that horrible sound.
That's funny. Microsoft seems to think that their Windows brand is really good.
They do?
I think so.
Huh.
Dr. Fiona Mulvey spends her days analyzing eye movement data and its relationship to the activity of the human brain. She's also the chair of the Cogain Association and the Eye Movements Research Association and a member of the International Committee for the Standardization of Eye Data Quality.
Awesome. And Professor Kenneth Holmquist leads the largest eye tracking group in the world in Lund University in Sweden. He's the author of the seminal work on eye tracking, the president of the Eye Movement Researchers Association, and a chair of the International Standardization Committee for Eye Quality Data. So welcome to you both.
So we're going to be talking about duck migration. No.
All right.
Okay.
So I heard years ago that the human eye's actual resolution, if you talk about it, a resolution, is actually quite bad. Like cell phones are better at resolution. Do you understand why someone would say that, and do you agree with it?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, partly true, but it's also false.
That's
spoken
a good
like a researcher. That's good. Yeah. So why do people say that the human eye doesn't have good resolution? When of course every time we see resolution and we think that's not very good, we're judging it with our eyes. You'd think that we have really good resolution. What's going on there that adds that level of sort of to your answer?
Well,
either of you, please.
The very center of your eye, the resolution isn't so bad, and you see color and so on. So, but you're talking about a very small area of your visual field. So,
what kind of angle we're talking about? If I hold my hand out, is it the size of my hand?
If you hold your arm out and put your thumb up, it's about the size of your thumbnail.
Wow, that is not
They're
very
your
big.
Registering color.
I'm doing it right now.
Yeah.
Wait, that's the space that you're registering color in?
That's right.
So why is it that I'm seeing color everywhere else all the time?
Because your eyes are attached to a brain, which is quite good at collating all those little samples of the visual world that you take in from your eye.
Okay, so what you're saying, and we've talked about this on Geekspeak before, but it's always a hard thing to really get, that your brain is painting in the color and the good quality vision that you see. Your eye itself is not actually very good compared to some of our visioning equipment now.
That's true. So your peripheral vision, so that everything outside that central area is quite good at sensing differences in contrast and movement and so on. But each of those photoreceptors or light-sensitive cells are wired up in different ways. So in the periphery, you get a whole bunch wired up together and feeding back, whereas in the center, you get each one wired up separately. So the individual signals are preserved and they're packed in tighter together as well.
I always thought it was actually the receptors themselves and you just had fewer of them. I didn't realize it was packed like that.
Yeah, it's also the density and how they're wired up to ganglion cells. And apart from that, you've also got lots of dead things floating around in your eye.
Yeah.
You might see when you look at a blue sky, you've got...
You also have a hole in your receptors where your eye's attached to your brain. The nerve said that we call it a blind spot.
Right.
Which, of course, none of us actually see as a blind spot, but it's there.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect example of how your brain tends to fill in anything, like a massive gaping hole in reality that it knows can't really exist.
So are you saying that the floaters that you see, the little, like, shapes that you see when you're looking at a blue sky are dead things or pieces of dust or something?
That's right. They're most likely dead cells floating around in the liquid in your eyeball that keeps
It'll become more clear as you get older, Ben.
Actually, it gets worse and worse.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's what I mean. Yeah. It gets more clear that it's dead things floating around.
Yeah, and the reason that you still see them is because they're moving, and it's much harder for your brain to catch up and remove blobby things that are moving around. Aberrations on your lens and so on, it's pretty easy for your brain to just polish those
off. So they're moving because your eye is moving. Not because they're loading in the liquid.
Right, it's fluid mechanics going on there.
So you're talking about the brain filling in both the color from the peripheral, from the center point, you kind of map the color and it gets added back in. And any changes that emerge in the environment, you reassess and rebuild that image. That's why it actually works. So that if somebody changes what they're doing over to my right-hand side with a different color, then assuming my center of my eye sees that, then I'll reset the color space. That's kind of what's going on all the time. But that kind of infers that your center detailed area has to look around a lot. Are our eyes darting all over the place all the time?
Yeah, they are. About 3 times per second.
3 times per second, what's happening?
3 times per second, you move your eyes to take in information in high detail.
Around the space?
Around the space, from your wake up in the morning until you go to sleep. About 86,000 eye movements per day.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a lot of movement. When I'm highly focused on a task, let's say I'm pulling a tweezer out of my kid's leg, and I am not moving my eyes because I'm doing that. I'm sorry.
Pulling a splinter with
a splinter. I'm using tweezers to pull
Thank
a splinter
God
from the
that.
Leg.
Okay.
Sorry, I've got kids. I get confused. I knew that was why that hurt. So when I'm doing that and I have extremely high detail, I'm not doing those kind of things, and therefore I'm not as aware of my environment. Is that, I'm assuming that's a concentration thing, but it's also just a physics of if you lock your eyes in one location, you're just going to become less aware of what's happening around you.
You have to stop your eyes to see anything, actually. So while your eye is in motion, all of that signal is blocked from further processing, so you're essentially blind during those movements.
Wow.
But again, which is a good thing, because if you imagine holding up a mirror and wiggling it around and imagine if that was the image that was falling on your retina, you'd start to feel quite sick quite quickly.
So when your eyes move, your brain stops pulling in data in the same way. It stops pulling the high detail data.
It stops pulling in any data.
Well,
actually,
pulls in color data, doesn't it?
No, when your eye is in motion, you don't take in any information from the outside world.
Wait a second. how does it then collect all the different color samples around the space and build that map of what's going on?
By stopping.
So when you say that your eye moves, it's actually like a jittery move.
You have stops and jumps. Otherwise, we call them fixations and saccades and lots of other smaller movements. But in general, your eye stops for maybe a couple of hundred milliseconds. During that time, it takes in information and then it moves for maybe 30 to 100 milliseconds. Uh-huh. And during that time, it's in motion in order that you don't feel sick and the world is stable rather than jumping around all over the place. You don't take in any information.
Wow. So this little thumb fingernail size of space that your eye can actually get color data and detailed data, it scans a space and stops. It takes lots of little snapshots, if you will, and builds that.
Okay. It's sampling the visual
environment.
It's
hard to believe. I love it.
There's lots of kind of tricks, actually, just to kind of show you how that works. I mean, if you have two objects that have similar level of brightness but different colors, so, you know, trick your friends, get them to fix a point on the wall and start bringing them in from the periphery. And especially if you've shown them one
object. From behind them, kind of, right?
Yeah, so they bring it into peripheral vision, and at a certain point, they'll be able to see the shape perfectly, but the color will, especially if you've shown them this object in another color beforehand, and they have this memory of the other color, they will actually see the color it isn't.
And it's not necessarily even a conscious memory, right? If I have an object on the desk, and they come in the room, it's a complicated room, and it's like a red cube, and I have them sit there, and then I bring that a different object that's actually a blue cube that's exactly the same, they might have already mapped and associated that color to that object without them being consciously aware of it.
Not only that, but what can also happen is, there's some really classic studies from psychology showing how, you know, someone stops and asks another person for the time or something like this, and then they rig up that a bunch of researchers walk in between the two people with a big window or something and blocks their view totally. And as they're going past, you swap the person completely. And the person who's being asked the time doesn't even notice that this has happened.
Yes.
And it can even sometimes go to the extent that they don't even notice when the person's gender changes.
Right.
So, yeah, we think we're seeing everything very sharply. That's our perception. And we think we're taking in a lot of detail. But actually, what's interesting about eye movements and the reason why it's so interesting for people like us to study is that it's very strategic where your eye is stopping and what information it's taking in. It's not random at all. Mm-hmm. It looks for exactly the right information for you to maintain your perception of the world, which may or may not be exactly what's going on out there, but it's good enough for you to be able to walk around without banging into things.
Yes.
Exactly. Catch a ball in space and so on. So
I'm a geek, so I'm interested in a lot of things, and magic's one of the things. I'm a pretty good sleight of hand person for at least 6-year-olds. And this, knowing this kind of stuff is actually how magic tricks work. It's really about saying, well, your brain's going to fill things in.
Exactly.
So it's amazing to me, a very simple tactic. Here's a cheat for everybody that wants to do magic. Have some objects on the table that you pick up multiple times with your hand. Just keep on picking the object up. And then one time, don't pick it up with your hand and say, I can make this disappear, and pretend like you're holding it. They will think that it's in your hand. And then when you open your hand to show that it's not there, it blows them away. Because, of course, the entire time, their brain is filling in that you've done that so many times that now they're like, well, I know what they're doing. As long as you can get your hand movement to be exactly the same, they'll put the object in your hand. Now, I don't know if they're actually seeing it in the hand, if, like, you know, consciously they see it in the hand. Sometimes I think that it is how it works. Like, I've, you know, reveal, and they're like, wait a second, that disappeared. And I'm like, you know, I know what happened. You should know what happened. So what you're saying, basically, that kind of tact, that's what's going on, is the person's brain is changing things, changing reality a bit to help the magician.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically evolution has given us these tricks to keep the world stable and flowing nice and smoothly.
Yeah.
And they work pretty well, usually, and it's only...
Do all eyes work this way when they move, they just don't take in data? Is that across all mammals, across all insects, too? Do you know about insect eyes? Harder to know, I guess, to some degree.
It varies a bit. Some of the animals have slightly different eye movements, depending on how their brain is built.
Do flying creatures have a very different type of eye than a non-flying creature?
Are we talking insects, or are we talking birds?
Like a bird. Let's go ahead and go stay in the mammals.
Birds have slightly different eyes than we do, yes.
Yeah.
Pupil look different, and acuity, in particular in prey birds. Like,
prey birds have really good acuity,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking like magnification kind of things. But also differentiation movement, landscape separation, right? So if something moves in the landscape, a bird that's even flying kind of complicated can detect that pretty easily. A prey bird can detect any kind of very, very, very small movement. So the peripheral movement detection is extremely good, I would assume. And that's actually why we have good peripheral movement detection as well. And the why we have good focus is because we have predatorial qualities, right? I mean, that's what you basically see in biology. You see the predatorial species have a certain type of eyesight, and the non-predatorial, like a grazing animal, is just a very different kind of eye because it doesn't really need a lot of focus, right?
And their eyes are on the side too, right?
Right, to go more
so
peripheral.
They can see more.
Let's talk about actually tracking eye movement. I remember years ago I was at the Exploratorium and I stuck my head in something that was tracking my eye movement. As I recall, what they did is they shined a bright pinpoint light above me. So they had something on my eye that was a small reflective surface that they could see with the camera. And then they did rudimentary tracking. And I remember trying to use it and seeing a lot of noise. I mean, the eye, as you said, it's scanning the room all the time unconsciously. You're, of course, blinking, but that's the least of our worries, right? Because at least that's a completely different, you can just remove that image from the scan. What you're talking about is taking a camera of some sort, some kind of digital data collector, and looking at the eye really, really, really fast, and then figuring out from that how it's moving, and from that inferring where it's focusing. That's hard, correct?
Exactly. And if you do that, you've built an eye tracker.
Has anyone really done that well?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are about 20, 25 manufacturers in the world who build eye trackers. They're all very small companies, anything between 2 and 200 people. And you can buy an eye tracker today. You have to pay $25,000-$30,000 for them.
For a good one.
Yeah, for a good one. Or you can download a webcam-based software and run an eye tracker on your webcam, but the data will not be as good.
Yeah. These expensive units, what are they doing that's a little different than using a camera?
Well, they are using cameras, actually.
Yeah, most of them do.
But mostly they'll be using infrared-sensitive cameras. So you usually illuminate the eye with infrared because it's invisible, and that means it's not going to interfere with your normal sight, and your pupil will stay large, which is also important for
tracking. And then are you looking at the back of the eye through the eyeball to do the tracking at that point?
No, we're actually filming the surface of the eye, and these eye trackers look at the pupil, which is one important part of the eye.
Yeah,
pupil moves around when the eye moves, of course. But it also uses a reference point, and the reference point is a reflection in the cornea, one of the outer surfaces of the eye.
Right.
So it tracks these two features, pupil and corneal reflection.
So you take your camera and to the side of it to some degree, you take an infrared, a hot pinpoint infrared source, so your eye, you're not being blinded by the light, you can't detect it. And then the camera picks up basically that reflection of the infrared point and then also the differentiation between your iris and your pupil. And from those two points, that reference, you can get this kind of... You're talking about high-resolution cameras then, right?
Yeah.
And close to the eye?
Can be, but not necessarily.
Are there any configurations that you have a zoomed-in kind of microscope away from the face?
Yes.
And then it actually has to move a bit to keep track of where the
eye
is?
There's one eye tracker which is exactly that. The eye follower from LC Technologies, which is actually a US-based firm.
And let me fill people in what I'm talking about, because that might have, we understood that, but maybe not everybody understands it. The idea is that you've got kind of a telescopic type of a zoom lens, if you will, of your camera that's aimed on the eye. And of course, as the head moves around, if it goes out of space, you can't see the eye, you can't see the reflection, you can't see all the things you need to track it. So instead, you just have the camera, you have two cameras. You have a big camera that actually keeps track of where the face is, and then you have a smaller camera that keeps track of the eye, and the smaller camera is actually moved by the data that the larger camera gets.
Right. So we call that a face camera and an eye camera.
Yeah.
So quite a lot of eye trackers will use a face camera and some image processing to locate the face in space. Mm. And then the second step is to locate the eye and zoom in there.
Ben?
So can I ask, what can you use this eye tracking data for? Like I've heard a lot about with regard to marketing, for example, and you look at where the eye looks if you look at an image or, say, a box of cereal or something like that. But what other possible ways can you utilize this data?
Where to start?
Well, do you guys have any eye trackers lot, right? in your environments? Have you ever used them for projects?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What do you do with them?
I mean,
we live with eye trackers.
In our lab, we have about 45 eye trackers.
Awesome. So you really feel like you're being watched. So you can, do you ever hook them up to something like, well, I'm going to do this. I want the coffee maker to start when I look over the coffee maker. Do you ever do that kind of thing?
Yep.
It's possible. And actually, one of the applications of eye tracking very definitely uses that, because eye trackers can be used by people who are physically disabled to yeah. control a computer and their environment. So look, basically your eye becomes like a mouse. And it can either be on a computer screen, or in some cases it can even be in 3D space. So you look at a lamp to turn it on or turn it off. And you look at an on-screen keyboard to type or write your emails or whatever else you need to do. So very definitely it is used in that way. But the largest amount of eye movement research and the most long-standing eye movement research is in inferring things about perception, attention, and cognitive processing from parameters of eye movements.
Right, so basically trying to figure out how people think by looking at their eye movement. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And the important thing there is how people think and not necessarily what people think.
Right, so, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can tell a certain amount about attentional states. You can see differences between experts and novices in terms of how they look at
sure.
information. You can
as
see
Ben alluded
how
to,
well
you can
someone is reading,
right.
so on.
And as Ben alluded to, you can infer how good an interface is by how the person uses it, by the data
sure,
you pick
yeah.
up on them.
It's used mm-hmm. a lot for usability testing and so
sure.
on. But also for things like, you know, clinical research, where you can see the effects of different drugs or alcohol and certain things with the eye movements.
Yeah.
Or
well, the data you were giving earlier about how much the eye moves and how it stutters by it goes and it can't pick up data, all of that kind of stuff is only because you have these sensitive pieces of equipment that can do that. It would be very difficult to try to assess this without capturing really good images of the eye movement.
Right.
And processing those. Do you guys look a lot at raw data, image data, or do you almost always process that image data into a chart, you know, into some numbers?
We almost always process it because the eye trackers that we use, they sample 500 or 1,000 times per second. It
yeah,
would
that's
not be
that's
viable to look
not
at
not an interesting
these,
Twitter feed. No.
We run it through algorithms and look at the data.
Yeah.
But having said that, we do spend a rather ridiculous amount of time just looking at plots of the XY coordinates of gaze yeah. because you can tell a lot about the quality of the data or the quality of the signal you've got.
By looking back at the image and saying, is that whole algorithmic stack that I've got behind this doing what I think it's doing?
Oh,
kind
well,
of confirmation.
Before you even get to the algorithm, mm-hmm. just that raw data coming out 1,000 times a second or so in XY coordinates. If you know eye movement data, then you enjoy looking at that and seeing
yeah.
how precise and accurate it is.
Sure.
So that's where you get into the really deep, geeky stuff.
So you look at feed.
I look at feed.
yeah. And you call it gaze, right?
I'm not ashamed
this
to admit
data
it.
Is gaze data?
Gaze data, yeah. Or
now, do you find yourself
data?
Looking at people's eyes more closely
no.
than no?
It's funny. Everyone always asks that. Are yeah. you looking at my eyes right now? No, we have machines to do that.
Yeah,
And I'm actually
we're not
short-sighted, so I can't right. even see your eye movements right
you're
now.
You're blurring me right now anyway. Now, you talked about hitting the eye with infrared and a small point of infrared. When I think of a small point of infrared, I normally think of a laser. Is that the type of... for making that pinpoint point on the cornea of reflection, is that what you're using as a laser?
No. Because that would be bad for your eye.
Okay. So you really need to have bright enough, but not too bright to damage tissue.
It doesn't even need to be that bright if the sensor is only infrared sensitive. It just means you need to be careful how much daylight is getting in, or else
yeah.
you need to pulse that light so the
right.
system
so
knows
you can detect
oh, you need
it.
To look for the pulse.
It's so funny because, you know, you're talking about the techniques of doing IR detection with cameras, and we do that at work. We do our interface stuff with this, right? So we will throw a video projector down and we filtered the IR out, and then we'll put a nice balanced IR light from one side, and then we can detect movement in the space even though the projector is projecting something different in the space, right? That kind of separation of concerns.
Just to give some context, IR infrared light, that's the same kind of light that your remote control emits when you press a button on it and you can't see it.
Right.
And that's one of the most useful things
so,
about it, right?
Yeah.
If you point it at a video camera, you can actually see the infrared light show up as
red on
the video.
This is something I tell people
camera.
All the time because I'm always dealing with equipment. If you're not sure if your remote control is working because of the battery, it's very easy to determine. You just take out your cell phone video camera and aim it at the you aim the remote control to the camera and look through it and hit the button and you'll see a bluish light. Or
how do I turn on the video camera without its remote control?
You have to use your cell phone. And I hope you don't have a remote control for your cell phone.
Well, my cell phone's broken. How do I tell if that's broken? No, never mind.
It's a really fascinating thing to see something so simple as having a video camera look at infrared, because people really get, oh, it's just the light flashing there at the end of my remote control. And as you said, the reason why remote controls work with a very minimal amount of light is that it's flashing a certain signal, and then the other side, the receiving side, has a whole processing, a whole analog circuit actually to detect only that frequency of signal, so it can determine that it's that versus something else in the room. And sometimes you'll notice that something will turn off or change on a remote control with no one using it. It's actually possible for a reflective surface with a pattern on it to have the same kind of shadow broadcast, if you will. But we won't get more into that. Let's get more into the eyes. We're speaking with Professor Kenneth Holmquist and Dr. Fiona Mulvin about eyes and brains. And every time I say your names, you guys all smile at each other.
Mulvey, yeah.
It's different every time. Mulvin? It's interesting.
Mulvey.
Yeah. But
I've only been doing this for 12 years. I'll get better eventually. Well, Fiona and Kenneth, how's that? Does that work
for us? That's much better, yeah.
So you guys have a lot of grad students you work with as well?
Yeah, I think there are around 10 of them in our laboratory at the moment.
Yeah, so you've got a busy space looking at trackers. You got an old eye tracker you could throw to an arts program in California? We'll talk about that after the show. Ben, do you have a question?
Yeah, I had a question. I had a clarification question. So earlier you were talking about how you could use eye tracking data to infer things about the way we process signals in the brain. Why exactly is that? Like, you and I, Fiona, were talking earlier about how you kind of have a feedback loop between the brain and the eye and the brain and the eye. Can you talk maybe a bit about that?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a feedback loop. I think I know what you're getting at. There's, in human vision, we have two separate streams of processing for eye movements. One which is much older in evolution, called a dorsal stream, which is helping us to locate things in space and how far they are and our own movements in space. So it's largely concerned with action.
So when you walk through a doorway, you don't smack your elbow every time.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then another stream called the ventral stream, which is more about that kind of top-down, as we like to call it, control of eye movements and looking at things in order to identify them as objects, in order to figure them out. And that's very dependent on central vision for high detail, mm-hmm. and so on. So reading, for example. And it's really interesting because there are cases, Oliver Sacks, for example, writes about where, you know, someone will have an interruption to the ventral stream, which is the conscious part of vision involved with, I'm looking at this cup. This cup is green, you mm-hmm. know, it's my cup, and so on. But have the older part of the dorsal stream still intact.
So you remove that conscious eyesight because of some kind of injury that occurs.
Some injury, sure. Or illness or so on. And what that means is that they will be consciously blind. So they will not have any experience of vision.
Oh, wow. But they can still pick the cup up?
But they can still walk around without banging into tables and chairs and so on.
Oh, my gosh.
So, it feels like a political disease.
I'm going to have to digest that for a bit.
Oh, wow. Well, in the sense that you can be conscious of the world around you, but have a very specific perspective, move through it, and not actually be conscious of it. Like that,
right.
That's kind of a magical space. How common is that type of disease?
Not very common at all.
Yeah, so when you see one of those people, you go, please come to my lab.
Well, indeed. In fact, when Oliver Sacks met, I think it was Oliver Sacks, wasn't it? When he met one of these people, he wrote a book.
Yeah.
But it can happen, and it can happen in the reverse as well, so that you can see objects, but you can't walk around without falling over chairs and things.
Where is this brain space that does those two things? I mean, I want to think of it as conscious and unconscious, but of course, you're conscious of your peripheral vision. You might not focus your attention on it, but you're to some degree conscious of it.
Sure, you might, and you may. Both streams of processing can use information from the entire visual field, but it's more like parts of the brain that have evolved for different purposes in vision.
Right.
And of course, everything I'm saying, it's not that it's completely uncontroversial. So
right.
Maybe I can...
And
maybe,
that's why there's interesting research happening in the space. Right,
exactly. Right? Yeah. But these divisions exist, and they exist even right down to frogs. Not in the same, exactly the same formation as they are in human beings, but you can see that the part of a frog's brain that allows it to hop towards food is different to the part of its brain that allows it to stick its tongue out and pick up that food in a very precise way. So, you know, we can infer...
Are those very similar to our dorsal and our what
they
we
would
call
be
focus?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is they're earlier in evolution. They're versions of what we've got.
So why are we... I find it fascinating that the easiest way to get to our ability to comprehend the world is through this extremely complicated, confusing way of doing it, right? It seems like it's designed pretty badly, actually, in the way that we actually pick up data in the world, in the sense that we've got these bugs where you can, bugs from a software metaphor, where you can trick the brain pretty easily. We see these with optical illusions all the time. You know, look, your brain doesn't work the way you think it works. That's really what those optical illusions are.
Right, but they're quite hard to find. I mean, I think you're being a bit harsh on evolution there, I have to say, because what you've got is two perfectly smooth, soft spheres housed in a perfectly protective, bony environment that give you a wide field of view that are designed to move very precisely, conjugately,
very fast. I'm not saying they're not elegant and wonderful.
So it's basically,
but they're also
like,
messy.
Well, they are messy, but it's based on heuristics. So many tricks and rules that we've learned as we've evolved and adapted to this planet have meant that we need to process much less information. So it's like, I guess we tend to think of processing power as being the ultimate thing, right? But if you have really, really clever software, you don't need so much processing power in the hardware, right? And you think about all the other things that the brain is doing based on that visual input. It's not only concerned with that. It's also concerned with what does that mean in an abstract sense.
Absolutely. You know? I want to thank you. We're out of time.
Okay.
Kenneth and Fiona, thank you so much for joining us on GeekSpeak. All the information will be at GeekSpeak.org, GeekSpeak's registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence.